Okay. Let's sail into some more data. It is very, very common for people to suppose, after reading the auditor's code, that evaluation for a preclear is the most destructive thing that can be done. This is not the most destructive thing that can be done to a preclear. Most destructive thing that can be done to a preclear is refuse to talk to him. So therefore, there must be some difference between evaluation and talk. When we say evaluation, we mean the interjection of an opinion. There's a great oddity involved here, and a great deal of material to be covered here, which you wouldn't suspect, really, from the tremendous simplicities which we are gazing upon today with the native state and first and second postulate. But I've just talked to you about something which actually undoes not just the riddle of life, but life. It does. It just undoes it. Takes universes apart, if you want to use it that way. But more importantly, it takes life off of an automaticity. There's nothing wrong with living unless you don't want to live. There's nothing wrong with dying unless you don't want to die. So the expression of desire is a very important point here. Now we assume in evaluation that the preclear is about to receive an unwanted opinion. And that's where evaluation is destructive. But number 16 of the auditor's code is much more destructive. We didn't even know that once upon a time. And therefore, we tore a lot of preclears apart without knowing why or how we were tearing them apart. We were being so careful not to evaluate for the preclear that we didn't talk. You have that very solidly there? We didn't talk. Well, now, here's a great oddity. I had in a clinical course unit one time, got darn little auditing. And they all came up scale. And all I did was lecture to them. And they had psychometric testing before or after the unit. Well, now, if talking was bad, and if data was bad, then that whole class should have gone out the bottom because they were lectured 2 hours every day. Talked straight at. And they were talked to about the basic phenomena of which they were composed. Obviously, then, this would be a terribly destructive thing, wouldn't it? Fantastic. But it should have pushed them out the bottom. And it didn't. It pulled several out of the top. They did very little processing, which you could have called processing. We were mostly exercising and handling emotions and things like that. Well, now there's some little data here to be resolved, isn't there? Huh? Just why is this? Why is this that one could talk, or I could talk, to a unit, quite a few people, on the subject of data and their cases and so forth, and they would experience a tone rise? Why? Well, for one thing, mechanically, very few people had ever talked to these people about themselves. And I definitely was talking to them about themselves in the most basic language conceived to date. Very precise talk about themselves. That's what was going on, wasn't it? About themselves and their acquaintances and their life and lives around them These things were being talked about, and the communication was being originated, wasn't it? And very few people had ever talked to them about this sort of thing, and it left a hole as far as communication origin was concerned. So if we'd just been filling up this other origin of communication, as far as they were concerned, we would have made some sort of case gain. Furthermore, I was not doing very much about their opinions. They could have any opinion they chose. They could have any opinion on any of this data that they chose to have. They did not have to become convinced that everything that Ron said was instantly and automatically completely right and not to be combated. Nobody was under that duress. Only when data has been widely applied and agreed upon in Scientology do we go to such a tremendous length of saying, memorize it. And we have yet to memorize any data which has not been widely agreed upon. The six basic steps were originated by Pohl. I did not dream up the order of the six basic steps. I asked a great many auditors for the very, very best processes they had found out of all the processes we had, and asked a great many people how their own case had made the greatest gain. And it was uniformly this way. One of the what became the six basic processes would be enumerated. We didn't even give them a list of processes, you see. All these people knew processes. One of what became the six basics, and then one or two wildcat processes. In other words, almost every process originated since Dianetics was mentioned as having benefited somebody. But only one person here and one person there, and nobody else mentioned it. There's a lot of randomness could have come into this. But in every case, we had one, two, or three of what became the six basic processes as having produced a considerable change of case. So you see how these six basic processes got there? Which processes had brought about a change of case for everybody? Quite interesting, isn't it? And that's why we learn the six basic processes. Every other process in the book, as far as I'm concerned, is therefore in contest. It's therefore in argument as to whether it's beneficial or not beneficial. I myself have a considerable number of opinions on this sort of thing, on these various processes. So do we all. But a great many auditors and a great many plea clears have agreed that the six basic processes produce change of case. Now, as far as the axioms are concerned, it took years to take the axioms of Dianetics, really, and boil them down to the axioms of Dianetics, and then years more to boil these axioms down and rearrange them to the axioms of Scientology. These axioms do produce change. Very, very definitely. Just studying the axioms produces a change of case. But here again we have something that has been widely agreed upon. Not polled to the degree that the processes were. We have something widely enough agreed upon that we find this is an interesting fact. That the memorization of these things brings about case progress. Memorizing them advances a case. And there isn't one of them there that doesn't click in a forgetter of some kind or another. So that people go wrong when they start to memorize these things. It keys them in. These are the basic agreements on the track. And what are we doing? We're doing a broad process there. We're trying to bring these axioms out of a total automaticity into at least a partial cognition. See how this could be? Memorizing the axioms is a case treatment. It's not that anybody will ever really need to sit down and parrot them. But we know this. that if somebody can't remember those axioms, they are on almost total automatic on every important point on the time track. And wow, they must be in terrible condition. You got it? It's very funny, but sometimes they can just do fine with 49 of them. But somewhere on the line, one is just going zong, you know. And they go over this thing and over it, and they sit there learning it with somebody, and he says, now let's go over it again. And they say, all right, the second postulate has what does it say? And the fellow helping them reads it through again, and they say, fine, all right, now, the what? What's happening? You have an actual idea which has become so automatic that it dives out of sight. And it persists in diving, and it insists on remaining hidden. And therefore, some segment of a person's life is on total automatic. Now, if we knew some other points that were as basic as the 50 basics, why, they'd be in the axiom lineup, too. But what I'm talking to you about, oddly enough, is axiom 36 when I'm talking about native state, first postulate, and second postulate. Now, that could be stated in such a way as to curve it into a greater embracement of the situation. It could be. You could be much more specific with it. But it was written before we know what we know here. See? In other words, the axioms are riding as senior theory along the line, and Lord knows what's in them. That's for me, too, you know. I mean, there's just no telling where any one of these axioms will go. But I knew that out of the original 50, we had certainly amply covered, if not entirely understood, the cornerstones of existence. See, we knew where these were. These were the branches of track. These were the points where things became more complicated than they had been before. These were the agreements out of which we made the complexity called life. And it was my feeling or intuition that not very much would exceed them, but that a great deal could be understood about any of them. And certainly enough, here we have this axiom 36 coming up, and cases going crash as a result thereof, which is quite interesting, isn't it? Theoretical extrapolation becoming concrete processes months after the codification of the theoretical. It's sort of mystic somehow, isn't it? Of course, it could be that I simply knew these things in looking around from a vantage point, but didn't know exactly how they applied everywhere. And that's the truth of the matter. That's how they took place. All right. Now, none of these things are inventions, beyond the fact that we have all invented them. And now we happen to be in an entirely different sphere of study. We are studying the inventions on which we have all agreed. We are not studying, then, artificial laws which are subject to many diversifications and interpretations. But that merely applies to the axioms. Second, we step outside the axioms. We are again in the field of opinion and consideration, and are once more tremendously at liberty. And actually, what are we pinned down to in the axioms? They're just the fact that each one of these axioms evidently has been a branch track affair where things became more complicated. We are evidently working with the pins from which the complexities of life stem. And if we were to pull out all these pins and run them all out thoroughly in all directions, we would then have to get very busy and invent them all over again to have the same kind of a universe. But to have them all on total automatic lands us up in a considerable confusion because these axioms, one after the other, in a conglomerate, automatic, ununderstood, not known state, would then themselves become a tremendous confusion. And so the very order out of which life is composed would itself be a confusion. And that's sort of an incredible thing to have happen, isn't it? The only things that make life orderly are themselves a confusion. That'd be horrible. It's something on the order of we lay out a beautiful road, a nice military road that goes from here over to Liverpool. A nice road. It's beautifully marked. It has all of the signs that it should have. And then, although the signs are still standing, we run along and we take huge black baskets and we upend these baskets over each and every sign and then add a tremendous number of black baskets to the sides of the road which don't house signs. And we look at everybody and say, well, can't you get to Liverpool? Look how well marked it is. And they say, yes, but there's branch highways going out which are broader and better than the central military road. Oh, nonsense. They all have guideposts. They do. We're lost. And it wouldn't matter whether you were in London or Liverpool in the center of the road. To some degree, you'd be lost. Right? And this is all the more silly because you were the one who stood there and assisted in erecting the signposts. And you were also the one who went out and got the black baskets and dropped them over the signposts. And you were also present when the road was being made. And yet here you are, a road which you helped make, mark, and obfuscate, on which you get lost. And we have just described the mind of man, the thinkingness of man. Now, there are very many ways, perhaps, how we could go about getting him unlost. But the best way to go about getting him unlost would be to understand the mechanism of lostness itself. And that would be a good way to go about getting unlost anywhere, wouldn't it? That'd be a nice thing. I mean, all we have to have is a mechanism of how you get lost, and then we get found again, wouldn't we? Well, I'll tell you about the mechanism of getting lost. The trick of getting lost or getting found depends upon the fact that one is never lost or found. Let's look that over for a moment. One is never lost, one is never found. All one does is says he is. Now, you can actually take somebody and you can get him to concentrate real hard upon how lost he is in life. You can do this in various ways, very covert ways. You can say, did it ever occur to you, those masses of people streaming by, going nowhere, doing nothing, without any real aim or goal, did it ever occur to you that they influenced your life considerably? See? Sharpen it up, you know. The next thing you know, this guy gets sort of confused. You talk to him about confusions, lostnesses, and then associate them with him. And the funny part of it is he'll go right along with you and play the game and become thoroughly lost. Why does he do this? Because he knows really that he's never lost. It's the only reason he'd ever play this game. Now we could convince somebody he was found. We could point out to him all these orderly markers and say, see, you're found. And the fellow would eventually say, wow, gosh, I'm glad to be located. But he is neither located nor lost, except as he himself says he is, or is brought to say he is. Now let's take an evaluative technique which would convince a person that he was found. Not to dip this lecture into the ridiculous, but let's take the Freudian libido theory of 1894. Now, Freud did say, if you just accept this fact that everything is based on sex, then to some degree you will be found. Anybody could make that consideration if he wanted to make that consideration, unless he was resisting sex itself, but nobody really wanted to make the consideration, but he thought he'd better make the considerations. This is how you got found. Actually, the rise in attention on the second dynamic, homosexuality, sexual practices in general, has been on a steep climb that looks like a jet plane going for the zenith ever since. Because all you have to do to get found is accept the 1894 libido theory, and you're partially found right there. Well, of course, to accept this thoroughly, you have to experience it thoroughly, of course. So, many people are getting found today simply by becoming perverts. See, that's an easy way to get found. You get this? You get this as a neat operation. Well, it leads into a very, very bad blind alley because it doesn't contain this datum. This is the only reason it leads into a bad blind alley. The missing datum is you can at any time consider that you were lost or consider that you were found, and you can say that anything is a guidepost and is the connective point to all other points. You can at any time choose a here from which you can get to any there. And if you want to make this lostness and confusion dominant, you would say, there is no here point from which you can get to there. You can't get from here to there, ever. There is no connective roadways leading from any here to any there. Now, if we let everybody get beautifully found on a point that won't find them, such as the libido theory, 1894, and then if we were to convince everybody who had thus found himself that this was a hoax, we would have introduced a brand new confusion which had not before existed. You follow this? Now that is the way you make confusions, is you let people consider that they are found by a certain guidepost, and then chop down the guidepost. And you have a new confusion. Therefore, the anatomy of confusion itself consists of permitting or letting or supposing that a thetan can find himself, and then supposing that he can lose himself. And then reversely, that he can now find himself again, and then that he can lose himself. But what do you know? Before a thetan finds himself, a thetan must consider that he is lost. And we get the first postulate of foundness is this incredible thing, lostness. Here's the oddity. Lostness is fluid. Motion. It's a dynamic condition. It contains in action lookingness, findingness, locatingness. It's in motion. And all these things cease the moment one says foundness. Interesting, isn't it? That the first postulate to being found is admitting you have been lost. Look how Christianity used this. Repent ye, for the kingdom of heaven is at hand. You're about to be saved. Farmer in the field says, huh? Now let me see. I'm about to be saved. I don't need to be saved. Oh, this fellow says you do too. Look how steeped you are in sin. Look. You realize that your soul is in peril and will be lost? The fellow says, my soul can get lost. And this is a true idea because actually he is only found in the middle of his field because he considers primarily and beforehand the lostness of the field. The motion postulate is lostness, on which one can get the ridge or fixity of foundness. Postulates 1 and 2. So the anatomy of confusion itself consists in being lost. And the resolution of confusion apparently consists of getting found. Any fallacy in this? If you really want to get yourself oriented, postulate you're lost. You'll get oriented. You'll get oriented in more places than you've been to in a long time. This is an oddity, isn't it? Getting found depends on having been lost. Finding anything depends on having lost it. These are sort of kindergarten idiocies. They are too idiotic for grown people to consider. It's obvious that they are. And that's why they have remained completely inarticulated all this time. It was necessary to articulate them before one could ever resolve a confusion. Now, what are you doing when you ask somebody to locate the walls of the room and the furniture in the room? Why does this work? You're ending the cycle of lostness in each case, aren't you? You're saying to him, now find yourself, find yourself. Find yourself, find yourself, find yourself, find yourself. Find yourself, find yourself. Well, that's fine. You feel better now? He said, I sure do. Well, how did he feel better? It's because he's postulated that he was lost, and the postulate of lostness has, to some degree, gone on automatic, so he doesn't realize that he's continuing to postulate his lostness, and you, out of your beneficence, permit him to get found out of his postulate of being lost. But if you tried to take him as a case and recover the automaticity of lostness, right there, instantly and immediately, your void spin. In the first place, you're dealing with space, energy. It's a low-level process. So if you ask him to go get himself lost, to get the idea he was lost, get the idea he was unestablished, get the idea of this and get the idea of that. Because it's a low-level process, you're liable to spin him before he would get anywhere. Because at one time or another, he could postulate lostness to such a degree that he felt psychotic. Ah, look how lost I am. And boy, did that make getting found a happy fact. His postulates, one time or another, could have been made with far more violence. And you find yourself drifting through one of these things. So the safe way to do it is let him find himself to the degree that he is lost. And here is a new stability. A new stability. But remember, you're creating a stability out of his postulate that he's lost. And this is as much a lie as the fact that he's been found, really. But because it's the first postulate, it can't be a lie. It's the truth that he's found is the lie. First and second postulate at work again, and disclosing to us enormously interesting data. Well, asking a preclear to be processed with his eyes shut is processing him closer to his native state, but with his eyes open. Bad eyesight comes about through the automaticity of the lost postulate. And here we have one of these other incredibilities. How to find yourself, get lost. If you know you're lost, you can find yourself. Another reason why the mind and its riddles was not instantly, immediately, and easily solved. because part of the bridge was I'm lost. It was more important to be lost than it was to be found. That is, to the mind. It was more important not to know than to know, as far as the mechanisms of the mind were concerned. It was more important to have no idea than to have an idea. It was more important to be incapable than to be able. So the moment anybody started into a study of the mind, he was liable to become stupid, incapable, lost. Interesting, isn't it? These are the automaticities he would run into. And the fact that we have been besting these things for some time and not running into them head on shows that we either have known all along more than was ordinarily known, or that we're lucky. Take your choice. Now, here's a funny thing. Although I caution you, this is not a process, because there are many cases that would find this process too horrible for words. You could simply have a preclear close his eyes and stand there and say that he was lost and that there were no orientation points and that everything was in confusion. And he'd feel found. But that is that skid phenomenon at work. See? The dynamic motion lostness is suddenly revealing a foundness. All right? So we would have to make him do it again and again and again and again until he was totally lost. Until, boy, when he said, I'm lost, oh, man, was he lost. No sensation of the hand, you know? Really making that postulate stick real good. And he'd run out its automaticity. And then make him turn around and say, all right, now find the wall. He'd say, boy, I sure am found now. Feels good. All right, you could say, get yourself lost. Okay, get yourself found. Get yourself lost. Get yourself found. Get yourself lost. Get yourself found. Now decide that being found is more important than being lost. He would. You'd have it right back on automatic again. But this time without all of its vagaries. Now remember, a person would have to be in pretty good shape before you could do this to them. You understand that? You have to have a lot of processing. Should be pretty well exteriorized. Pretty stable. If you were to do this to somebody in their head, I couldn't guarantee for a moment what would happen. He'd probably go zong, zong, spin, spin, scream, scream. And you would be saying, please, say something. Think of your poor auditor. He's lost. See how that could be? Now, do you see some of the ramifications of the first and second postulate? Well, more importantly, do you see why opening procedure 8C is functional? Now, the funny part of it is you can always run the second postulate, but don't really try to run the fourth postulate. If you want to make any fast gain, don't run the fourth postulate. You can run the second. You can get away with running the third. But by the time we've removed it to the degree of the fourth postulate, we have an alter-isness of a not-isness. And we're not taking over an automaticity anymore. We are merely continuing to alter a not-isness. And so we get greater and greater solidity, and we get more and more mass. But if you want to make a universe, for the love of Pete, make it by running the fourth postulate. What is the fourth postulate? Native state. Total knowingness. Total ideas without an idea. First postulate. Don't know. No idea. Second postulate. No, an idea. Third postulate, forget. Not isness of knowingness. Okay. Fourth postulate, alter the third postulate into rememberingness. And that alteration by itself gives you the energy ridges which you know of as engrams, facsimiles, so forth. The action of remembering puts into existence these ridges. We sure know more about anatomy right now than we did. Fellow hasn't got a leg. I would conduct this experimentally if I had a little time. Fellow hasn't got a leg. I'd just have him consistently and continually create a leg and then remember it. Create a leg and remember it. Create a leg and remember it. Got the idea? Or I'd say, no leg, no leg, no leg, no leg, and have one appear by counting on the automaticity. But if you had him create a leg and then go through all of this zoom, zoom, I mean mock up a leg, you know, and then go through and remember that he mocked it up. And then mock it up and remember that he mocked it up. Leaving forget on automatic and a few other things like this, you'll probably get there. Who knows? He might all of a sudden have a leg. Of course, we can't guarantee what kind of a leg he'd mock up. But if a lot of us, by experiment, were to mock up a second moon out there, we get an agreement on where we think it should be and what its rate of spin around the Earth should be and a few other things, and we plotted out this orbit exactly, and then we'd mock it up and remember it was there, and mock it up and remember it was there, and then mock it up and forget we mocked it up and remember it was there, and mock it up and forget we mocked it up and remember it was there. Who knows but what there might be a second satellite spinning around Earth. Of course, we haven't any idea of what gravitational effect it would have on Earth, but just let's disregard that. Now, here's a heavily theoretical, almost ridiculous example of how to make matter. Now, you don't have to make it by this system at all. You can simply say, space, matter, persist. Because the thing can do that too. But he's chosen this other route, see, where he wants agreement, where he wants mutual observation, where he wants mutual appreciation and communication and the game itself. He chooses this other route, which is native state, first postulate, second postulate, third postulate, persist on that fourth postulate. By that time, you've got an all-or-isness of a not-isness, and boy, can things get solid. The fellow who sits there remembering that he had a leg will at least get a ghost leg. Where do these ghost legs come from? You know, fellow's had his leg cut off, and it still itches, and he's still worried about it, and he can sense it, but nobody else can, and he can't walk on it. Well, he's just doing an awfully poor job of remembering. Very unthorough. The creation of the leg was an automaticity that came along with the body, so he doesn't bother to do that. He simply remembers existing facsimiles of that leg, and these, of course, increase into a solidity which eventually has a considerable sensation in it. See? Now, as many parts as you leave on automatic will leave holes in your ability to create and do. As many parts of first, second, and third, and fourth postulates as you leave on automatic. Now, there's an oddity. The action of creation lies between the first and second postulate. Isn't this an oddity? It's sort of offbeat. You say, there's nothing here. Oh, I know what that is. Yeah, that would be. Well, there's no lions in this room at all. Oh, I know what kind of a lion that is. Libyan lion, yeah. So a thetan has other little tiny things that he does at the same time. He's got a third left hand over here that's got a little mock-up machine, you know, that chucks something in there so he can know about it. It's very silly knowing about nothing. So he kind of says, "Oh, what do you know?" It's real cute. Now, this is not necessarily part of the action at all. See, I mean, it's not necessarily part of native state first postulate and second postulate. It's just something to know about. And he does this, too. Now, he could do these things in various orders as far as creation and destruction are concerned. But it's easy for him to create, and then because he puts remembering on automatic, it becomes very hard for him to destroy. Because he's created this thing and then goes on and remembers that he has it, it, of course, gets more and more solid. And one day he says, "You know, I'm awfully tired of having a Libyan lion roaring around this room all the time." Now, let's see, what does it say here in the magic textbook? Well, it says, presto, change-o, abracadabra, and then at that moment, you're supposed to twiddle your fingers in this pattern, and zong goes the lion. All right, now let's see now. Zong, presto, change-o, abracadabra, twiddle. Damn, lion's still running around the room. Now, let me see. Well, I tell you what I'll do. I'll invent a gun and shoot him. Boom! Now what do I do with this corpse? He's still got a lion. What's the right way of getting rid of this lion? Well, there are various ways you could do. You could put him in yesterday and then forget him. You could put him in tomorrow and then hope you won't live that long. Various problems come up at once, aligned with the destruction of the lion. When you choose, as man normally chooses, alter isness as the mechanism of destruction, you get persistence deluxe. You keep trying to alter things in order to destroy them. And, of course, the alteration of them continues their persistence. Now, the actuality is that you could just change your whole mind about the thing and say, "There is no lion here." Now, the theory is that you could do this if you were not in the time continuum which you have elected the lion to exist in. Got it? You just step outside that time continuum. Of course, you haven't got a lion anymore. He exists in a time continuum. What is a universe? A universe is a time continuum of postulates. And all you have to do is step off that time continuum, do anything you want to. You notice this phenomenon every now and then of remembering tomorrow. You sort of step off the time continuum enough so that you're disassociated from it a bit, and then you can skid around on it. You get deja vu, another interesting manifestation. But let's step all the way off of it simply by closing your eyes and starting to mock up your own universe. Well, this would be all right if you merely went on mocking up your own universe. If you weren't dedicated to and connected to the head in some fashion or another, you'd probably float off and have another universe. And you'd probably have nothing more to do with this one. What would you have done? You've just gone in from... You've assumed native state and you've made your first and second postulate different from and outside of the time continuum of postulate one, postulate two. Because the second you say postulate two, you have time. You've started time when you said postulate one. But when you said postulate two, you've got continuing time. And now if you go and make postulates three and four, you're going to get solidity. So what is the best way to get rid of these things? And why do people have trouble with this and get obsessed with destruction? Because they get destruction on time as an automaticity. They hope the lion, after he's shot, will rot. You know? And they say, well, a few years from now, he'll just be dust. And we can at least sweep up the dust and sort of pretend it isn't there. Well, there is actually a method by which you could destroy this lion, which would have nothing whatsoever to do with the decaying of the corpse or lugging him out or throwing him in yesterday or any one of these things, all you'd have to do would be to as is the lion. But trying to as is him and living in the same time continuing with him and being something also in the same time continuing with him, your effort to as is him is very unsuccessful. Unless you yourself can disassociate yourself from the time continuum to which you are partner. And if you can disassociate yourself, you could, of course, make a perfect duplicate of the instant of creation of the lion. And right now, no matter how many eons his track has gone, he will go. You see this? You make a perfect duplicate of the instant of creation in the space, in the time, with the energy of which he was created. Well, that's very unsatisfactory because it dislocates you entirely. It influences a large number of actions which were influenced by the fact that the lion had been created. And we get one of these, if they looked at it as a German schema, you know, you get these things, they one line here and then that gets two words. And then each two of the two words get to be four words. And each of the four get to be eight words. And we get one of these highly complicated geometric progressions. Which is horrible to contemplate, really. And we as is the lion here and find out that we lose our bout noir here. See, because the cross-influence of the creation became so complicated that trying to influence one single factor and leave all other factors uninfluenced is impossible. So how do you get rid of the lion? Just wipe out the whole universe of which he is a part. And wipe out anything of yours which is a part of that universe. And you'll get rid of the lion. And that's why people say, do not send to find for whom the bell tolls. It's ringing for you, bud. You see, you are so much part of the things you have created. Everything you have is a counter-influenced measure. That we get some kind of a weird complexity whereby you cannot wipe out anything completely at its source without influencing many other things completely at their sources. And because you're unwilling to lose some of your possessions, you therefore suffer whenever you cause anybody else to lose some of his. But as far as the mind is concerned, all you have to do is remember who created the lion in the first place. If he's merely a mental lion, he will really go away. Because, you see, he hasn't been remembered often enough to become a powerful, roaring beast visible to everybody. You created him without agreement. You created him, see, with nobody else. You just mocked him up. You said he was there. And you didn't create any additional agreement with relationship to him. And therefore, he's a free lion. You see, you're totally capable of freeing this lion because he doesn't influence any other factors. You see how this would be? But the roaring beast that races across the field and is about to spring on you, that's been a long time since you mocked him up. You see, the way you did it, you probably were standing around, and if you can see anything at all, you were probably a partner to its mock-up. One way or the other. You agreed to let it be mocked up, at least. And you agreed to let the basic lion of all lions be mocked up because of this princess. And you thought she ought to have a nice gift, so you all got around and mocked this up, and you got her to agree the lion was standing there, and so she got a lion, you know. And it was very terrific. I mean, she was a nice-looking mock-up herself, and leading a lion around made quite a show, you know. And you say, boy, that's really good. And she was really pleased, so she made you a knight of the lion. And everybody agreed that you had a mock-up here, you see, and it was a badge, and you were a knight of the lion. And people talked about this, and they remembered this lion that was mocked up and given to the princess. Now, do you get some kind of an idea of the cross-influences of these agreements? Only trouble is, you were executed because you disobeyed the vows of the Order of the Lion, you see. And this influenced... first and second postulate become the 1 billionth postulate, the 899 billionth postulate. You get the idea. Each going on harmonics, one to the last. And we get a universe. But is there anything wrong with this happening? No, there's nothing wrong with this happening at all, unless you yourself are totally pinned to and cannot in the least degree disassociate yourself from any part of that time stream. And if you are in that time stream as a total automaticity, then you are a total slave. See how that could be? And that's what people object to. And that's what aberration is. Objecting to being in this time stream without ever being able to get out of it. Did you ever have the feeling, oh, if I could just get off by myself for one afternoon, you know, and kind of read a book or look at the sea or something, you know? You're trying to partially disassociate yourself from the total time stream by at least disassociating yourself from the standard humdrum connections which you have. You see this? So we get this impulse. And when you fight back against the impulse and everything goes on total automatic and you can't do anything about it anymore at all, you begin to feel you were lost or something of the sort. Whereas the actuality is your surroundings and so forth are so ephemeral that your conviction and the conviction of your fellows has to be doggone good all the time. It's so easy to unmock this universe that you have to be careful all the time not to think of the magic word hippopotamus. And the magic word hippopotamus is, it doesn't exist. There is nothing there. And this truth is, of course, the freeing truth. But after you've run this truth for a while, you're just as likely to say, well, no London, no London here, no London here. There isn't any town here at all. No town, no town. You'll find the buildings starting to do strange things, you know, and your eyesight will change and a lot of other things will change. You say, no town. Isn't it a peculiarity how there's no town here at all? No town. No town. There's nothing here. This isn't even an empty void. There isn't even any space here. There isn't even any space called London. After you run this for a while, and it's what you've done, you see, is you've done a skid for a while, so it brightened things up. And then the skid stops being automatic, and it really starts coming true. And it gets awfully dim and very thin. And how would you remedy that? You'd say, do you remember London? Do you remember the time we got lost in the fog? So people are always careful to have a bunch of pleasant memories around. Get the idea? We must store up a lot of pleasant memories. In case London ever started to disappear, we could only remember them, and we'd get London again. Get the idea? That's how you keep your own switchboard tuned up to the switchboards of others on the existing reality. It is unthinkably complex. Don't let me underestimate that for a moment. It is terribly complex. How all of these agreements fit into all of these agreements, making this solidity and this beingness and so forth. The interweaving lines are so fantastically interwoven, so apparently completely inseparable, that a man, not knowing how they came about, can look at them and just himself go into apathy about it. He can read book after book. This book is all about life. And finally, maybe he reads a book about some wise man who gave a young man the answer to the riddle of life. And the young man was very disappointed to take the answer in a bundle home and unwrap it and discover a very intricately patterned old Turkish rag rug. And ponder over this for a long time. If this was the map of life, this must be it. And he finally goes back to the wise man, and the wise man says, has no pattern at all.
See, it just meanders. No purpose, no pattern, nothing. We read things like that and we go into apathy, you know. There's apparently something there, but it doesn't quite meet the eye. And after a while, we're just liable to give up and just drift on down the time stream. We've forgotten so well that we can't remember what we have forgotten. Well, you have to step back off the time continuum, not very far, but just enough to perceive this fascinating point. Native state, first postulate, second postulate, and here we go. And that is the basic of the picture. If one did look at this tangled rug, the only meaning it could convey is not that life is meaningless, but that lostness precedes foundness. That disorder precedes order. But that you don't have to have either one. And that is the additional trick. You don't have to have either one. But because people are living, and because people are playing the game, and because they really want to go on playing the game, and play it better than they were playing it, why, they want the lostness and the foundness too. They want the knowingness and the unknowingness too. They want all these things and all these ingredients. So the only thing we can really do for them or anybody is simply to make it possible for them to take any and all of these various ingredients off of total automatic, put them onto consciousness, and then teach them as well to put them back on total automatic. All three steps are necessary in order to accomplish a resolution of a case. If all you did for the case was to take him off total automatic and then skipped him, this would be a very sad thing. You have to teach him not only to come off total automatic, but to make the postulates and put them back on total automatic. In other words, he's got to do all parts of the cycle. The moment he does, he becomes master of the time continuum for any given universe. And having become that thing for any given universe or situation, he can, of course, at will, be part of or separate from any time continuum, and as such is free, and that is the only freedom there is. Thank you.